Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema. Hello everybody and welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdale. I am a writer and film critic, and today I have the pleasure of talking to Michael Shulman, the author of Oscar Wars, the tale of Hollywood in gold, sweat, and tears. It is a brilliant history of the Oscars, and it shows you the development of the Motion Picture Academy and how it has changed over the years, how it's developed, how it's become the thing it is today, including explosive incidents, mistakes, slaps, the whole lot. If you enjoy the conversation, please remember to leave a review, a rating, and spread the word generally. That would be great. You can subscribe, of course, and you can follow me on Twitter if you like, at Dr. Jonty, DrJonty. I'm also available throughout other social networks with some sort of variation on Dr. Jonty usually. But before you do any of that, please enjoy the conversation. Is coming out in paperback soon, is that right?
Yeah, on February 20th.
I'm someone who has become not virulently against the Oscars.
Wait, have we started, by the way?
Yeah. This is it.
Okay, not virulently against the Oscars, but...
But, and you know that anything that comes after but, anything that comes before but is nonsense. But yeah, a little bit disenchanted by the way the whole of the industry has sort of, and by that industry, I don't mean movies necessarily, but entertainment journalism has kind of, it's become you say it in your book, it's become a cottage industry in and of itself, right?
It certainly has. Yeah. I mean, in not just in media, but for PR and marketing people, strategists, you know, there are jobs where people just plan award season and spend the entire year positioning movies, basically. There's a whole department at Netflix for awards, you know. It's like, it is a cottage industry for sure. In entertainment journalism, their entire websites and podcasts and whatever else devoted to awards. There's a lot of it, yeah.
It's a lot, isn't it?
But I'm not like, I feel like you're sort of putting me in the position to defend the Oscars, which I will, happily. But I also want to start by saying that the Oscars are absurd. Like, they're ridiculous and over the top and insane. And that's part of what I love about them, is the excess and the sort of foolishness of them. And I hope that the book strikes the tone of saying that they are both meaningful if you look at them the right way, and they can teach us about how culture evolves and how movies and Hollywood evolves. But they are also ridiculous and funny, and we should kind of laugh at the ridiculousness as well. So that's kind of the tone I wanted to strike.
But that's precisely what it is, what I wanted to say, because I it sounded almost like I was going to do a gotcha interview. It was like, I've got you on here to trap you and tell you what I think about that. But that's it. It was the idea of, oh, do I really want to read a book about the Oscars? And then I read the book and I was like, yes, I absolutely do want to read a book about the Oscars, because it's such a great sort of history of how we got to where we are and where it all started. Because even right from the very beginning, the whole idea of what is the Academy? You know, what are we going, what are we even making this for? You know, the naming of the Academy, right from its very inception, was a sort of controversial project, right?
Yes. I mean, people might be surprised to learn that the reasons the Academy were founded had nothing to do with awards. Awards were just, you know, something on a list of brainstorms of what they might do, you know, when they came up with the idea in 1927. Awards are basically the thing that survived and became most successful that they did, because it turns out people love winning awards. But many other things that the early Academy did were despised. You know, at the beginning, you know, it was founded by, it was the idea of Louis B. Mayer, the head of MGM, of course. And, you know, their early rhetoric was very utopian. They saw themselves as like the League of Nations for Hollywood. It's very 1920s. That was going to promote harmony within the industry and, you know, promote motion pictures throughout the world and yada, yada, yada. And that's all great. But there was a lot, if you look under the hood of some of that utopian vision there, you know, there's a lot of controversy. You know, for one thing, Hollywood had a terrible image problem, in part because all of the sex, murder, and drug scandals of the early 20s, like, you know, the trials of Fatty Arbuckle and the murder of William Desmond Taylor and all those great, like, Tinseltown scandals, and the threat of government censorship of the movies was on the rise. You know, the conservative religious element of the country saw Hollywood as a cesspool, a den of sin, and sort of the embodiment of, you know, post-World War II libertine mores. And that was a real threat to the industry. And part of what they did was create the Hays Code. But the Academy was part of that idea that let's rebrand and let's call ourselves not a cesspool, but an Academy. You know, it's very lofty.
The Athenaeum of motion pictures.
Exactly. Exactly. And then the other thing that was going on was the threat of unionization. You know, like I say threat, it was a threat to people like Louis B. Mayer. What was happening was that, you know, the craftspeople were unionized, but the actors, writers, and directors were not. And there were inklings that that might happen, and that the creative professions might form guilds. And that was a threat to the studio heads like Mayer. And so what the early Academy did a lot of was, you know, by harmony, they meant, you know, adjudicating employment disputes and negotiating in contracts. And they were hated by a lot of the rank and file because they were seen as a company union, a sort of tool of the producers to control everyone, which was kind of true. And it actually worked, in the sense that it forestalled the creation of the guilds for several years. You know, like SAG didn't form until deep in the Depression in 1933. Mm. And once that happened, the guilds hated the Academy. They really went to war with the Academy. They would tell the new guilds would tell their members to resign en masse from the Academy. It's either them or us. And they would boycott the Oscars. And it took until the late 30s when Frank Capra was the head of the Academy. You know, he loved winning Oscars. He loved the Academy, and he saw that they were hated for all these sort of labor role that they had. And so he just said, "We're not going to do that anymore. We're going to jettison all that and just keep the awards because everyone seems to like that." And that's sort of how the the purpose of the Academy took shape.
And it's brilliant going through your book. It's such a, because in a way, the Oscars are like the, what's Hitchcock called them? The MacGuffin of the book. That they go through the book and you're learning about that, but you're also really learning a huge history of Hollywood as you go along. And so I would recommend this book to anybody who, as I say, who comes from my position of being slightly miffed by perhaps where we've arrived with the Oscars, and certainly in terms of social media and maybe a bit being, you will get a great history of the Oscars, but you will also get a great history of the movies in general from this angle. What I, Capra does, you know, he's a funny guy because he's made some amazing films, but he doesn't come out of it particularly well.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. I had a friend who read a draft of the book and he said, my conclusion is that I hate Frank Capra, which surprised me because I think there's a lot to admire about him. And he sort of, you know, his own account from his somewhat fictionalized autobiography, the name of the above the title, he talks about how he sort of positioned himself. He was desperate to win an Academy Award, and according to him, he kept making different movies to try to win an Academy Award almost before anyone else really was paying attention or cared or found the awards that valuable. And then, you know, amazingly, he was an Italian immigrant and sort of pull yourself up by your bootstraps kind of person. And he saw the Academy as the Brahmins and, you know, the establishment that he wanted to crack. And he finally won that Oscar. He won like every Oscar for It Happened One Night. And then he became the president of the Academy right after that. The crazy part is that the Academy was getting attacked by all the guilds, and Capra would not join the Directors Guild. He wasn't really a pro-union kind of person. Until finally, he had a big dispute with Harry Cohn over a movie at Columbia. And then he got really angry at, you know, the studio bosses. And so he not only joined the Directors Guild, he became their president as well. So he was the president of the union and the president of the Academy while the unions were attacking the Academy and threatening to boycott the Academy Awards, where he was emceeing as president. And so he was basically the general of two sides of a war at the same time. It's such an insane story. And yeah, I think you could see it as a kind of opportunism and, you know, he was sort of driven by a lot of self-interest. But I mean, there's like, you almost have to admire just like the gumption of it all.
The chutzpah.
Yes. Yeah,
absolutely. I do love, going back just a little bit, I do love as well how everybody's arguing about stuff. It's always that great thing of history that history just arrives to you. You're born into the world and there it is. The Oscars exist as they've always existed. But there's a time when people were saying, should we just give them a scroll or should we give them some kind of trophy, or, you know, and how it's you know, how who named the Oscars, for instance, becomes a huge sort of debate, and it's not resolved. Everybody's competing to say, oh, I named it after my uncle. And
Right. I mean, I sort of loved noting those little moments along the way when these bits of, you know, ceremony fell into place. Just even the drama of opening the envelope, you know, at the beginning, they just released the winners and runners up to the press, and they were printed in the newspaper. And then they finally figured out, oh, we can create a little suspense at this thing if we, you know, keep it a secret and open the envelope. And, you know, seeing something like the red carpet take shape, or opening medleys and production numbers, you know, hosts. And I mean, that's not really the driving force of the book. Like, and the horse race isn't the driving force of the book, but it's sort of through those things you can sort of track how Hollywood's evolving and kind of what else Hollywood is freaking out about, whether it's labor relations or, you know, the blacklist or, you know, the 60s generation coming up. You know, the Academy always has to deal with change in the world and in movies, and to see them struggle with it, I think those are the interesting points along the way. And so the book was never going to be a blow-by-blow of every single year and what won and what lost. I have those books on my shelf here. You know, they're, most of them predate Wikipedia. So, you know, I value them, but I wanted to write a book that was really narrative driven. And so it would just, the idea was just to choose about a dozen years to like really delve into, and years that told a larger story about something bigger that was happening.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's very, let's not go through it necessarily chronologically, because I find my mind is hopping about here, because I think one of them really interesting.
Let's hop.
One of the interesting ones is the way you describe the Miramax fight, because that they, in many ways, Weinstein, Harvey, really institutes the sort of new aggressive going after the Oscars. And I just thought the way you wrote about it was brilliant, because you do this thing of inserting these sort of paragraphs where, and by the way, while he's doing this, he's assaulting this actress in this hotel, and he's doing this here, and it interleaves through the story of Miramax trying to win an Oscar for Shakespeare in Love. And it just shows how insidious he is, that this was all going on at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, that was very tricky. I had actually started writing the book before the scandal, before the Me Too movement. Obviously, you know, you can't tell the story of the Oscars without Harvey Weinstein, and yet you can't tell the story of Harvey Weinstein without this much more important thing that has happened since. And, you know, what, of course, was happening during. And that story has been told in a lot of really great books, you know, by, you know, Ronan Farrow and, you know, the reporters who broke the story, and She Said. So I really thought about it hard, because I didn't just want to set that all aside and tell the story of Harvey Weinstein, Oscar maven. It's sort of, you know, it's an incomplete story. And yet that's the story that was told about him at the time, that he was this sort of bully, but he had this magic Oscar touch, and it was this rise and rise and rise, often on the backs of other people who he, you know, filmmakers who couldn't stand him or who fought with him. So what I thought I could do is tell both stories at once and show you how they were linked. In other words, I think that the line in the book is like, he was building himself a golden shield. You know, how did he use that reputation for the golden Oscar touch to avert people's gaze and to amass the kind of power that he needed to keep the, serial sexual assaults out of view, or intimidate people who might catch on, or intimidate, you know, the many women who otherwise might have spoken up. So that, you know, it was a very hard chapter to write. And at the same time, that infamous year, 1999, of Shakespeare in Love versus Saving Private Ryan, has sort of been reduced as well to this idea that Harvey like bought the Oscar and that the wrong movie won. And once you look closer at it, there are so many interesting twists and turns in that story. And as much as people love to talk about the Miramax side of it and the Shakespeare in Love, you know, aggressive campaign and everything, there's a whole other story to tell about DreamWorks and Steven Spielberg and Jeffrey Katzenberg, and why this campaign for Shakespeare in Love so drove them up the wall, and their kind of counter campaign that, you know, DreamWorks ended up spending more money in the end for Saving Private Ryan than Miramax did for Shakespeare in Love. It's not remembered that way. But so looking at that company as well, I thought was really fascinating.
So they basically bought the Oscar but didn't get the Oscar. You know, they spent the same money but didn't get it.
Yeah, I mean, they spent more. And the important thing about that in terms of Oscar history is that, you know, DreamWorks really felt assaulted by this sort of renegade guerrilla campaign from Miramax. And it worked in the sense that Shakespeare in Love won. And I think there are a lot of legitimate reasons why it won. You know, people loved, actors love it. It's about actors, you know. In a way, it's a sort of funhouse mirror of Hollywood itself. It has tons of industry jokes. It's light and romantic and, you know, not a bad movie. But people, there was this assumption that Saving Private Ryan was the front runner. It was Spielberg's big war epic. It had been the front runner for half a year before Shakespeare in Love even came out. And then there was this business about how, you know, was Harvey negative campaigning? And I sort of, I had been hearing different versions of this, and I actually found the person in the middle, who the journalist who had heard Harvey tell her, oh, you should write XYZ about Saving Private Ryan, that it's only good in the first 25 minutes during this D-Day sequence, and then it just becomes a standard World War II movie. That person alerted DreamWorks, and then they, you know, Harvey denied, but that is sort of what activated this, you know, all-out war. And anyway, after, because it worked and because Shakespeare in Love won, DreamWorks basically said, we're not going to let this happen again. And the next year, they took the, you know, what was being called the Weinstein playbook, and they did it double. You know, they spent more money and they hired more consultants and they won for American Beauty. And then they did it again the next year and invented more things for Gladiator. You know, they had started having talkbacks, like, you know, at special screenings. How many times, you know, this is just a staple of Oscar season now, but it was a way to out Weinstein, and it worked. And then you get this just arms race of campaigning, and suddenly every studio needs a, you know, a SWAT team of strategists and a, you know, huge budget, and it's talkbacks that go on for months. And that's how it got bloated.
And I mean, my thing with Saving Private Ryan is it wasn't even the best Second World War movie that year. I mean, I think The Thin Red Line should have won. But I mean, a serious question. What happens with that kind of film, a film that probably doesn't have much chance, doesn't have much. The director is not going to show up for a Q&A. He's not going to do the red carpet. He's not going to even turn up to the Oscars. So what does Fox do with The Thin Red Line when it gets nominated?
Not only that, but there were two Elizabethan movies that year, because there was also Elizabeth.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Cate Blanchett.
And I think one of the, you know, more suspect wins was in Best Actress, when Gwyneth Paltrow beat Cate Blanchett playing Elizabeth.
Oh, my God. I forgot about that.
But then also Judi Dench won Best Supporting Actress for her, like, 8 minutes on screen as Queen Elizabeth. So it was, there were a lot of Elizabeths. There was a lot of World War II. You know, Life is Beautiful was another Miramax movie that year, which is also a World War II movie. Yeah, it was kind of a strange year where everything was either World War II or Queen Elizabeth.
Doubled. Do you, what was that year that they had Frost Nixon and they brought out all the actors to read out? And Anthony Hopkins was on stage and a whole bunch of others. I think it was Michael Douglas. And they read out the nominees. And one of the nominees who won in the end, I think, was Frank LaLanga for Frost Nixon.
Oh, Frank Langella.
Langella, sorry. Yeah. God, I'm garbling names at the moment. Frank Langella and whoever was reading the sort of the little bio of him said, Frost Nixon, in which Frank Langella does such a brilliant portrayal of Nixon, nobody else could ever do it. And I'm just thinking, wait a minute, Anthony Hopkins is stood right next to you.
It's right there.
It's right there, man. What do you think? Yeah, it's
I know. We need Nixon versus Nixon. Yeah.
It's so funny how the Oscars is just ripe for this, for these kind of contrasts and doublings and, you know, moments of unintentional humor.
Absolutely.
Okay, so when did you start sort of covering the Oscars sort of professionally? Were you, did you, you attend them, you've attended them in the past. When did you start attending sort of the Oscars as in person?
Yeah, so I'm a staff writer at The New Yorker, and I used to run the office Oscar pool. And that kind of grew into me covering the Oscars for The New Yorker website. And, you know, The New Yorker is not a place where a ton of people are into the Oscars. I'm kind of like, I'm a little bit lonely there. You know, like we're a few floors away from Vanity Fair where everyone is obsessed with the Oscars. And I'm like the only person at The New Yorker who's like, the Oscars are happening. And what happened was the year of Oscar So White, 2016, I pitched a story and I said, we should really do like a long story about the Academy and how they are grappling with this racial reckoning. And at the time, the president of the Academy was Cheryl Boone Isaacs, who was their first Black president. And of course, this was at the end of the Obama era. So, you know, there had been a lot of attention paid to sort of, you know, Black leadership. And she was overseeing this initiative to diversify the membership in all sorts of ways, racially, by gender, age, international, and it was getting a ton of pushback and sort of turning into its own little culture war. And so I went out to LA and met with Cheryl Bone Isaacs and went to the Academy headquarters and wrote a kind of long piece for The New Yorker about what the Academy, you know, this controversy over how the Academy was diversifying. And this was, of course, against the backdrop of the Trump 2016 election. So that came out like right before the Oscars. Then I went to the Oscars for the first time to cover them that year. I was sitting in the press room, and at the end of the night, this is 2017 now, they open the envelope for Best Picture, and it's La La Land. But then it's not La La Land, it's Moonlight. And I just still remember the scream of, you know, the press room, everyone collectively screaming like, oh my God, something's actually happening. We're not used to this, you know? It's not just the ceremony and pomp and circumstance and the gushing, you know, award acceptance speeches. Like there's actually a kind of mystery to solve. It was like a whodunit. And so I covered that evening, and it just, to me, felt like I had witnessed this sort of epic story of Hollywood during this period of time, you know, not only going through having gone through this year of racial reckoning, then having this sort of insane Hollywood surprise twist ending where Moonlight wins in the most nutty circumstances. And it was like this, you know, to me, it just looked like, you know, like a movie. It was like a movie. And that's sort of where I got the idea for the book, because I was like, I could encapsulate this year in which a lot happened. And then there are other years that sort of also had a kind of war of ideas or war of, you know, different elements of the culture or politics. You know, for instance, in 1970, Gregory Peck was the president of the Academy. And I learned through doing this New Yorker piece that he had also done this kind of initiative to update the membership by bringing in younger people and, you know, demoting older people who hadn't worked in 7 years. And that had been very controversial. And he had gotten like hate mail from Academy members that are still in his files at the Academy library. And so I kind of built a chapter around that too. And the Peck purge, you could call it, was actually one of the precedents that Cheryl Bone Isaacs pointed to when she was, you know, doing this in 2017 or 2016, saying like, look, you know, Gregory Peck saw that, you know, the end of the 60s or beginning of the 70s was a time when the Academy had to move with the times and bring in new people and stay relevant.
Surely he should have issued a pecking order. I had that locked and loaded already.
Oh gosh,
I'm sorry. I apologize, Michael. I'm so sorry. I'm gonna go over to Vanity Fair now. I'm sure they'd appreciate that. But yeah, I mean that runs through the book as well. These conflicts in terms of, well, specifically race. I was thinking of Gone with the Wind and
Hattie McDaniel, yeah.
Hattie McDaniel and her situation where it's sort of it's a win, but it's a win for playing a certain type of role. And you have a similar sort of point with Sidney Poitier, that there's a, you know, that he's playing a sort of acceptable figure, but at the same time he's personally has gone through a great deal to get there. Mm-hmm. And is often, you know, privately a lot angrier than he seems. And I just thought those, and then that of course leads right up to things like the Nate Turner Birth of a Nation, right. and the infamous slap, which has, I mean, you describe it, the Chris Rock Will Smith slap, as sort of almost, there's like almost a nexus where everything is meeting, of race, aggression, violence, sexuality, you know, jealousy, that all these things, public, private, are all exploding in the same place. And it, I mean, in that sense, I came out of the book with much more of a respect for the Oscars as a sort of cultural event. You know, yes, tacky, yes, this, yes, that. But at the same time, it's kind of good to have that sort of prism with which to see things.
Yeah, I mean, the first line of the book is the Oscars, it should be said from the start, are always getting it wrong. And yeah. I always say, if you look to the Oscars as a barometer of cinematic worth, you're always going to be disappointed or enraged, because there is no such thing as best picture or best actor or best whatever. Like, it's art. You can't, it's subjective. And so they're always getting it wrong. They're always leaving things out. They're always making the wrong choice or the choice that you don't agree with. And you kind of can't, you know, art's not supposed to be ranked like sports teams. It is supposed to be discussed. Movies should be discussed. And I think the Oscars give us a platform to talk about what we think was the best of the year, what we liked, what we didn't like. And even if that discussion is about complaining about the Academy, which certainly happened this year with Barbie, that's part of the point. And then so that's my kind of defense of all of this, you know, Oscar hoopla every year. But then I would also say, to go back to the point you were just making, is that the Oscars are really valuable as a kind of decoder for how Hollywood sees itself or wants to see itself. So, you know, for instance, to take that moment of Sidney Poitier being the first Black man to win Best Actor in 1964 for Lilies of the Field, which is a very kind of small, kind of random movie for him to win for. But if you look at sort of what surrounded that win, Hollywood had just gotten into essentially the civil rights game. You know, they had sent movie stars to the March on Washington, including Poitier. And it was a moment of realizing that after the pain of the blacklist and the sort of paranoia around and the fear around aligning behind, you know, sort of lefty causes, Hollywood finally realized, actually, we need to be a part of civil rights. And that kind of energized the Poitier win. But for Poitier himself, as with, you know, Hattie McDaniel and Halle Berry and a lot of the, you know, firsts in their category, it's a very fraught experience to be that person. It's very isolating. You know, they, you know, you carry an entire community's, you know, hopes and criticisms on your back, and you're the face of something that is not just an actor in a role. And all three of those people, I kind of weave their stories together because there were a lot of parallels in how they sort of, it was a very bumpy ride for them. You know, obviously a great honor, historic moment. Everyone says historic, historic, historic. But then, you know, they all faced a lot of backlash, including from the Black community. They all had sort of career stumbles right after that happened. And they all felt kind of hemmed in by the acceptable persona that they had created on screen.
Yeah, I mean, Halle Berry, I forgot how much, you know, how much she was mocked, really. And it, you know, I mean, she's not the first actress to be very emotional when giving a speech in accepting an Oscar. And yet she seemed to get a virulence that was way beyond the, you know, what was called for.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was incredibly stunning to me to look back on what the public reaction was to her speech at the time in 2002, because we just remember it as this like very emotional, meaningful, wonderful moment of her crying and saying the door had been opened and she's standing on the shoulders of all these people like Dorothy Dandridge who'd come before. And it's, you know, it is that, but it was also, you know, she said, I felt the tear down the very next day. And you see this coverage of people, you know, writing into the newspaper, to the LA Times, saying, why did she have to make it all about race? And Saturday Night Live, like, you know, making fun of her for crying and, you know, thanking Tootie from The Facts of Life on Weekend Update. And, you know, it just went on and on and on. And then the next movie she makes is Catwoman and she wins the Razzie Award. Like, it was such a swift downfall, as well as, you know, a Black academic at the time attacking her in The New York Times for being too sort of trading on her sexuality. You know, she won for this movie Monsters Ball. It's about an interracial romance, and she got criticism for that. She got criticism for from Angela Bassett, who revealed later that, or she claimed that she had turned down the role because she didn't want to play a prostitute, even though the role is a waitress. So there were just all, it was a lightning rod. It's the kind of thing that if it happened today would be a Twitter, you know, discourse for weeks. But then, you know, if you look in sort of newspapers and magazines around the time, it was definitely not the way, it didn't play out the way it's remembered today, for sure. And I wanted to explore that, the kind of messiness of it.
I mean, do you feel, so goes so goes the Oscars, so goes America, in the sense that there seem to be so many parallels. Like when money enters the game in a huge way, it's like money entering political campaigns in a huge way. When you know, when you have these flashpoints of, you know, don't play the race card. Race card. I'm using air quotes here on a podcast, so that's great. You know, that's. You know, there's endless attempts to enter into a post-racial moment when it just doesn't seem possible. It keeps coming back again and back again. I mean, are those parallels justified, do you think?
Absolutely. I mean, that was, I would say, like a major way I thought about the book is that, you know, how are the Oscars yoked to American history and major moments. I mean, and it's not just dropping in, you know, oh, and then, you know, Nixon resigned at the same time. It's like, no, Nixon resigned. And then we got, you know, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest about sort of a corrupt authority figure, and Jaws, which also has a corrupt mayor who looks a lot like Richard Nixon.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And we get Nashville, you know, also about in which there's like a corrupt presidential candidate and a political assassination, and A Dog Day Afternoon, which is also kind of like that has that sort of jaundiced 70s vibe. Like those were the Best Picture nominees in 1976. And so I sort of look at that race and just how the mood of the country was reflected in these movies. Or the 1942 Oscars, which happened 2.5 months after Pearl Harbor. And it's not just, oh yeah, Pearl Harbor happened. It's no, actually Pearl Harbor and America entering World War II completely realigned the movie industry. The movie industry had been very timid about tackling, you know, the rise of Hitler and the war in Europe as it was then. And then suddenly, arm in arm with the US government, it became a machine for pumping out war, patriotic war movies. And so those Oscars, you know, are really fascinating to sort of crack open and look through that lens. I mean, Wendell Willkie gave a speech at that ceremony, sort of cheering on the war effort. Gary Cooper won Best Actor for this movie, Sergeant York, which was essentially like a army recruitment tool. So, yeah, I mean, I absolutely think these sort of signposts, major events in American history, they changed the mood of the country, they changed the mood of Hollywood and the Academy voters, and they sort of serve as a meaningful backdrop for what happens in the horse race. And so it's not, again, so yeah, as you said, the horse race is like the MacGuffin, the Hitchcock term for like the plot device. But if you kind of look a little closer, as I tried to do with these years, you see that... actually, what's at stake are ideas and cultural values and values of aesthetic taste as well.
And it's also kind of, we referred to it earlier with the attempt to, there's this cyclical sort of generational change that is happening. And you sort of get that with, you know, the Marlon Brando protest and the, you know, John Wayne wanting to get on stage and Shirley, you know, the hearts and minds win with Bert Schneider reading the speech of the letter from North Vietnam peace envoys. So you keep getting this generational feel that it needs to be renewed, but at the same time it's being dragged back. So you'll get a green book when everybody wants a more forward-looking picture. Do you feel that the Academy nowadays is moving in a way that's more hopeful? Or a way that do you see there's going to be, I don't know how to phrase this really. I mean, I guess the easiest way to ask the question is who's going to win the Oscars this year? Because go ahead without me. I'm not going to.
Well, right now it's looking like Oppenheimer, but like okay, there's a couple things I would say about that. I would say that since the Oscars so white year, the Academy has been very much paying attention to inclusion and diversity, which is of course a huge issue in the country at large, and sort of is something that many, basically every institution is looking at and being criticized for. And you know, this, for instance, this is the first year that the Academy has used these eligibility rules for, you know, diversity for a movie that for a Best Picture contender. You know, the winners have been, I'd say if you look over the past 5 years, it's been a really interesting period for what Best Pictures look like. I mean, Parasite, Moonlight, Everything Everywhere All at Once. These are certainly not Green Books or Driving Miss Daisies or whatever.
Nomadland.
Nomadland. I think maybe this year is a more conventional year in the sense that there are more big budget studio hits like Oppenheimer and Barbie, of course, that are major Oscar contenders. But I certainly think that, you know, Parasite, which was the first non-English language film to win Best Picture, that was possible because the Academy became much more international in its voting membership. You know, Fellini never got nominated for Best Picture, you know? So there was a kind of xenophobia for many, many decades. Moonlight winning was, I think, a gigantic deal. And it echoed 1970 when Midnight Cowboy won. It was like the arrival of a new kind of movie that could win Best Picture that had been inconceivable before that, that a movie like that could not just be made, but win. So yeah, and then yes, it is often two steps forward, three steps back, and you get a sort of more conservative, boring kind of win, or conventional, I should say boring, but like a movie that, you know, kind of fits the mold. But I think what's exciting is seeing those like moments of those wins that kind of energize you, that have this like spiciness, because you're like, ooh, that's an interesting choice. Like it that is not what you would expect a Best Picture winner to be. And yet it is. And now we live in the world where Moonlight and Parasite have won Best Picture, and a sort of kung fu fantasy, you know, like, you know, multiverse, you know, family drama about, you know, an immigrant laundromat owner is a Best Picture. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's really exciting to watch.
I think sometimes those pictures, those wins, it almost feels like the Oscars need Parasite more than Parasite needs the Oscars. I mean, I'm sure Parasite was very happy to get the Oscars, and it opens up a whole new audience and a whole new and a re-release and what have you. But it's sort of, as you say, it rejuvenates the actual institution itself. One of the things which is really funny in the book and really interesting is the idea as well of the ceremony, and especially sort of the who's going to host the ceremony, how they're going to host it. And this sort of focuses in on a particular year where I can't remember the year. Was it early, late 80s? Was it
1989? I think you're talking about 1989.
Yeah, I'm talking about the worst Oscars ever.
Yes. Which is also in quotes, because I feel like I defend them in some way as not quite, you know, not significantly worse than, you know, the year before or the year before that. But it was a fiasco. And for people who don't know what we're talking about, this is the year 1989, where the show opened with an 11-minute production number in which Rob Lowe sang Proud Mary with a woman dressed as Snow White in a replica of the Coconut Grove with dancing cocktail tables. It's like a gay fever dream. It's insane. And the man behind it is Alan Carr, who was a producer. He produced Grease, and was a, you know, flamboyant gay man who wore amazing caftans and through sort of like incredible bacchanals at his home in the Hollywood Hills. And he dreamt his whole life of producing the Oscars, finally got his chance, created this insane, campy 11-minute opening number. And it was so disastrous that it basically ruined his career.
And it's kind of tragic in that sense.
Yeah. I mean, I sort of thought of this story as like a tragedy within a comedy because the details are all completely ridiculous, like this sort of insane 80s excess. But at the center of it is someone who's kind of like an Icarus who flew too close to the Oscar sun and then plunged into the sea and ruined himself. And part of it was hubris. You know, he spent the whole lead up to the Oscars sort of putting his name in the press and saying, we're going to bring back the glitz. We're going to bring back the glamour. It's going to be bigger and starrier. And, you know, people don't usually know who is producing the Oscars. Like, do you know who's producing it this year? Do you know who produced it last year? No, it's not something that the public generally knows. But that year, everyone knew this was the Alan Carr Oscars. And so when they didn't go well and they got panned, everyone knew where to point the finger. And then there was this snowball effect, like Disney threatened to sue over the, you know, use copyright infringement for using their version of Snow White. And then all these Academy elders like, you know, Gregory Peck and Blake Edwards sent this open letter saying that it had brought shame upon the Academy. And basically, it just was the end of this guy's life.
Yeah, I mean, it's horrible. And then Rob Lowe has a sex tape scandal, and it's kind of Twitter. It's all Twitter before Twitter, isn't it? It's just like...
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, but that's what I love, because you can even go back to 1941 and find something that would have been a Twitter scandal had Twitter existed. It just plays out in, you know, a little slower and, you know, head of hopper columns or whatever. But it's there, you know, these little flare-ups always happen. And I remember last year when the book came out, an interviewer asked me, this was right after the Andrea Riseborough, you know, to Leslie surprise nomination and the sort of crazy way that happened. One interviewer asked me like, so is this the craziest Oscar year of all time? And I was like, this doesn't break the top 10. Absolutely not.
It doesn't chart.
We kind of forget. We forget that like crazy shit happened in 1935, you know, and the Betty Davis snub of 1935, I believe it was, like, that was the, you know, Andrea Riseborough fracas of its day.
Yeah, absolutely. What was there was one Oscars that I remember was Billy Wilder. I don't remember it personally, but Billy Wilder was nominated for a bunch of Oscars. And was it All About Eve and Sunset Boulevard were up against each other?
And, they were, yeah.
And All About Eve won everything. And as Joseph Mankiewicz kept going down the aisle, Billy Wilder stuck his foot out, tripped him up at one point. Because he was just so, the first few he was graceful about, but after that, it was like, oh, sod this guy.
Oh my gosh. No, I, as you know, I have a whole chapter about the best actress race of 1951 because it's so stacked, you know, Betty Davis and Ann Baxter in All About Eve. And Gloria Swanson in Sunset Boulevard. And the winner was somehow Judy Holliday. Actually, no, I shouldn't say somehow. She was amazing at it. Judy Holliday in Born Yesterday. But just these, you know, these iconic performances all at the same time.
And some of them are in like New York waiting. And some of them are, you know, they're all sort of scattered. And the press are in front of them waiting for them to hear.
Oh, yeah.
The radio.
This is so funny. Yeah. So. Gloria Swanson was nominated for playing Norma Desmond, but she was in a Broadway play at the time. And back then, you know, people didn't make a huge effort to go to the Oscars, especially if they were doing something on the East Coast. And so she wasn't planning to go. She claimed she never really cared for awards or Oscars. She was nominated the very first year. And she's like, it's apples and oranges. It's all phony. But it was her birthday right before the Oscars. And the people at her show, her Broadway show, so let's throw you a little party on Oscar night for your birthday. And they found this restaurant in the theater district called La Zambra and planned to have this little gathering after the play. And that turned into, within like 24 hours, it turned into like a huge batch with hundreds of people, including all the Oscar nominees who were in New York at the time, and press from, you know, every major radio station, you know, sticking microphones in front of them, and, you know, photographers taking pictures of every single moment. And, you know, Judy Holliday was there sitting right next to Gloria Swanson. And like the reporters were trying to get them to like fight. <You know? laughs> I mean, it's just ridiculous.
Oh my God. And I think there's a bit where Julie Halliday wins and Gloria Swanson describes it as like suddenly she felt terrible, you know, that it was, oh, I don't care. And as you say, you know, it doesn't really mean anything. And then when she lost, it was like, it's the worst feeling in the world.
Well, she was annoyed that people just kept trying to create drama and sort of wanted her to play the role of Norma Desmond in life and be this like diva movie star, and there's almost no way to win in that scenario, because if you keep saying no, I don't care, you know, it's sort of like you know the more you protest that you don't care, it sounds like you do. So
yeah,
everyone's kind of caught up in the theatrics of it.
Greta Garbo really does want to be alone. don't stop hassling her all the time. She say it, okay, I want to be alone. coming back to the present day, one thing that sort of again ticks me off lightly, I mean, I really don't care, but at the same time I do, is the talk of snubs, because this idea that it goes from being something you're awarded, something that your peers are saying, ah, there you go, to being like, oh, if somebody I like hasn't received one of these nominations, then it's a snub. I mean, I can't understand Margot Robbie not getting Best Actress being a snub. I mean, Ben Stiller didn't get Best Actor for Zoolander, and it's the same performance. It's not, you know what I mean? I don't understand. The performance is not that good, is it?
I mean, I think every so-called snub's a little different. And
right,
what they have in common is that, you know, it's kind of like what we were saying about the cottage industry and the media frenzy. By the time the nominations come out, there's a kind of received wisdom about who is in the race. And so when none of those things actually, when those things don't get nominated, there's this shock because everyone thought, oh, I thought, you know, she had a slot. And no one has a slot. Everyone's just, you know, there's five empty nominations and they get filled by what the branch votes for. You know, this year there's been some uproar over the documentary feature category because they're all international films and these big starry vehicles that had huge, you know, that had like money behind them, like the Michael J. Fox documentary or the John Batiste documentary weren't on the list. And it's like, there's so many documentaries made every year. Like, why would you assume that those had, you know, a slot in quotes? And, you know, yeah, I mean, I don't object to the word snub as much as some other people do who follow this. Like, I think it is telling and meaningful sometimes when someone who is very much assumed to be in the race is suddenly not. And, you know, I think we can learn from those things. Like, why didn't the Academy go for this? And they also are part of the sort of, they're part of the discussion. I mean, going back to Betty Davis again, like when that was really the first major Oscar snub. When she wasn't nominated for Of Human Bondage in 1935. And it was so outrageous to people that she wasn't nominated for Best Actress that the Academy had to change its policy and allow write-in votes. And she still didn't win. But, you know, you could just by looking at this controversy, it sort of shaped the course of, you know, then she won the next year for Dangerous, which she thought was terrible. And she writes in her wonderful memoir, The Lonely Life, how, you know, she thought Katharine Hepburn deserved it for Alice Adams, but she was winning for the previous year as a kind of a consolation prize. And the next year, someone else, you know, Katharine Hepburn will win the Oscar that someone else should be getting. And she says it's like the original lie that breeds like a bunny or something like that.
Martin,
and it's so true.
Martin Scorsese winning for Color of Money when he should have won for... Oh, no, Paul Newman.
You mean The Departed, The Departed, yeah.
The Departed, yeah. But Paul Newman won for The Color of Money and he should have won just historically for The Verdict or something.
Exactly. And this is part of the reason why the nominations get all screwy, is that people are sort of winning for the wrong movie or losing for the right movie or winning a sort of career capping Oscar for not their best work. And again, this is why I say, like, if you just sort of look at the Oscar winners as like the definitive movie canon, you're going to get it wrong. And the Oscars are always getting it wrong, but they're getting it wrong for interesting reasons.
I mean, that's what strikes me as so ironic about the Margot Robbie thing, is I've seen Barbie, and she got nominated as a producer, and as an actress, she's a great producer. You know, I think she was nominated. I think the Oscars got it right. She was nominated in the right category. I don't mind if Barbie wins the Best Picture. It's a great, enjoyable movie. It's a brilliant. It's a pity that Barbenheimer can't win the Best Picture, because really that's been the phenomena of the year. That's right. A really interesting sort of amalgam. But yeah, it's funny. But I'm you know, if there's a snub, why wasn't Bottoms nominated for anything? That was the best feminist comedy of the year.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, it also tells you a little bit about how the Oscars isn't great about rewarding comedies, is often sort of ambivalent about huge commercial hits. I mean, last year, Top Gun Maverick, which supposedly saved movie going, according to everyone, got nominated for Best Picture, and I believe screenplay, but it didn't get the directing nomination or Tom Cruise for Best Actor. That's the same exact result as Barbie.
Right.
So I think that tells you something. Like, it's, you know, these big movies that, you know, quote unquote, save cinema, that sometimes doesn't matter in certain ways to particular branches. And I think there is this continual tug of war for the Academy between commercial success and, you know, artistic merit and what they're supposed to reward. And that goes back to the very first year when there were two top prizes in 1929, one for outstanding picture and one for unique and artistic picture. I mean, that kind of tells you everything.
We should have done that. This is the year we could have redone that and just had Barbie and Oppenheimer. And the only argument would have been which should win which. That's the...
Well, it's like the Golden Globes did do that. They had best box office achievement or something, and it went to the movie that made the most money, which was Barbie. Like, I thought that was really funny. Yeah. The award for most money.
Yeah. And what do you get?
And it goes to the movie that made the most money, Barbie.
You get more money. It's a bit like putting a hat on a hat in the end, isn't it? I felt the same. You mentioned it earlier. You were talking about DreamWorks learning from Miramax and winning the Oscar for Gladiator. And I remember watching Gladiator and thinking, I love it. It's great and everything. But, I mean, it's like giving Star Wars an Oscar. Does it really need it? You know, I mean, it's got every, you know, it's... I grew up with this idea that the Oscars was supposed to be in some way about promoting. Perhaps that's where I get a bit jaded, is the idea that it's promoting a certain kind of movie. That's why I liked it when Nomadland won, because Nomadland needs people to go and watch it, or Moonlight needs people to go watch it.
You are making the defense of the Oscars that I sometimes make, which is that it's sort of the only huge structural force in the movie business that, you know, ostensibly puts art over commerce. You're not supposed to win for most money. You're supposed to win for the best movie, even if that's a tiny little movie that very few people saw. Does it actually work that way in practice? No, because there are all these other things that influence what people vote for, including commercial success and which people are well-liked and charming and who mounted a clever campaign and got a lot of press. And then when a movie like Nomadland wins, the viewing public is kind of mystified because a lot of them didn't see it. And they don't know what the hell is the Academy's talking about, and they complain, you know? So, you know, I think it's, you know, the Academy is trying to be two things at once. The Academy Awards are both an industry prize based on merit voted on by various branches to award their peers. And they're a big TV show that has to get millions and millions of viewers in order to, like, fund the Academy. So those things are sometimes in perfect alignment. They're often in conflict with each other.
And are you going to the Oscars this year?
I am, yeah.
Excellent. And what do you think will be the... have you got any predictions that you'd like to share? Do you think there's going to be any scandal? Who's going to slap who? I mean...
Well, see, that's the thing. I love the surprises. Yeah. I was there for the envelope mix-up and the slap. And those of them, you know... It's amazing because you think...
Wait, you were dancing with Will Smith. You were dancing with Will Smith after the slap.
Oh, let me tell you. I had just turned in the manuscript of Oscar Wars to HarperCollins, and I didn't like the ending. I had written a sort of very cursory afterward. And I thought, this kind of sucks. I'll have to rewrite this. And then I go to the Oscars the next month. I see the slap. I wind up at the Vanity Fair party watching Will Smith dancing with his Oscar on the dance floor to Gettin' Jiggy With It, and with a huge smile on his face. And I was just like, this is the most surreal, dark, crazy image.
God wrote the ending
Thank
of
God,
your book.
Like, I know, like, the Oscar gods gave me this ending. And then the next day I was like bedridden with COVID. So I sacrificed for that ending.
Oh my God.
But I would do it all again.
Absolutely. That's, you're putting your body on the line for the Oscars. I think someone should give you an Oscar for writing this book, Michael. I really do. What would your speech be? Have you thought, you must have thought about it in the course of watching all the speeches. You just must have thought, I'll do a Joe Pesci. I'll just walk up there and say thank you and walk off.
I know. Thank your agent, your team.
Yeah. Thank you.
I don't know. I mean, I also love watching, I love the cliches of acceptance speeches and watching them change over time. Like, at what point did people start thanking my team all the time?
Right. Yeah.
It used to be my agent, my manager. Now it's like my team. I have to thank my team. And then at a certain point, people started reading off of their phones for their acceptance speeches, which I really, there's the cliche of like telling your kids you can go to bed now. Someone did that at the Golden Globes, I think, and I saw that their family lives in like Australia, so I was like, isn't it noon? I don't know. I just find it so funny, these things that sort of become, you know, speech cliches.
Yeah. Matthew McConaughey saying that he was the hero. His hero was him in 20 years or him in 5 years. And then another hero is in it.
That is an incredible speech. And he's like a revival preacher in that. He says like his hero is always him 10 years in the future. So he's always chasing like his future self. I'm like, it's like the founding text of a religion or something.
I would, one that I'm ashamed to say I would join in a heartbeat. Matthew McConaughey, say what you like, but you always say it from the back of your throat, man. It's an amazing gift you have. I'll buy your Lincoln. Final question, Michael. Recommended film book. It's a question I ask every guest. What film book would you recommend our listeners to have a look out for?
Oh my gosh, I've been reading so many lately. Let's see, what have I read lately? This new book, Burn It Down by Maureen Ryan, which is really about the abuses in the underbelly of the industry and sort of how it should be reformed. It's a really powerful book by Maureen Ryan. I just recently read for the first time What Makes Sammy Run, the classic 1941 novel.
Yeah, Schulberg.
By B.B. Schulberg, about a sort of Hollywood climber, this sort of a Sammy Glick. That's a really fun read for anyone who
I've never
get
read
their hands
that.
On it.
I've never read that,
it's
but
so
it,
good.
It comes up all the time, so I should really get my hands on it.
Yeah, I mean, I love memoirs. I love great celebrity memoirs. Like I mentioned, Betty Davis, The Lonely Life is so good. It's so good. Gloria Swanson's, I'm just naming some books I read for my research, but Gloria Swanson's autobiography, Swanson on Swanson, is like, you know, it's not even mostly about Sunset Boulevard. There's so much detail about her career in the silent era, and it's so richly detailed and done. And there's a crazy Vanity Fair story about sort of the writing of the book. Sidney Poitier's first memoir, This Life, is really so dishy. And then the book I'm just reading now is another kind of modern classic, which is You'll Never Eat Lunch in This Town Again by Julia Phillips, the sort of tell-all memoir that just is, you know, I love a tell-all, and she really just lets it loose. So it opens at the Academy Awards in 1974 when she was a producer The Sting, and she watches The Streaker, and she just talks about how much cocaine she had throughout the night. I read that, but the first 20 pages I'm like, oh, sold.
I mean, actually, can I just add this as a question? What the reality of being there is, I mean, it's a little bit like, I mean, I go to Cannes, I go to Venice, so I go to places where, you know, you can, they're very glamorous and all the rest of it. So, but I always wonder about the Oscars. What's it actually like to be in a theater? And is it, you know, is it the long queues for the toilet? Is it easy to be there? Or
first of all, people may not realize, but the Oscars are at a mall.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
You're absolutely at a mall. And so you're going up like escalators, and behind every, you know, wafting golden curtain is like a Hot Topic. So it's all, you see the kind of smoke and mirrors of Hollywood glamour. You know, you're like, you look one way and there is Lady Gaga, the other way you see like a Sephora.
You know, 50%
it's really
off.
Really weird. Yeah. So I'll continually find that. One year, because I'm such a New Yorker, I think you can walk everywhere. I was so stupid. I tried to walk to the Oscars because I didn't read the instructions about how you enter. And I got trapped in this like sea of humanity behind a chain link fence of just these incredibly huge crowds sort of yelling and taking pictures at the limos. And I was the one person in a tuxedo. I was like, you know, like a Where's Waldo situation. And I was next to these people who had signs that said, Hollywood eats babies. Hollywood elites eat babies or something. And I was like, who are you? What brought you here? And they're like, nothing. We're just here to have a good time. And then a limo would go by and they go, Hollywood elites eat babies.
If only, total if circus. Only they did. I love it. That's so medieval. It's sort of like, burn the witch.
I know.
So what are you doing Wednesday then?
Do you want to get some coffee after this?
Exactly. After we burn the witch. What are you working on next, Michael? Is there anything, if you've got another project on the go?
Right now I'm not working on another book quite yet, but I'm doing my other job, which is The New Yorker. And right now I'm covering Oscar season. So I just did an interview with Lily Gladstone, for instance, and I'm sure there'll be more Oscar coverage coming out. And
she's going to be in the slot, isn't she? She's got to be the one to beat, I think.
I think so. I mean, part of me, the conventionalism is that it's Lily Gladstone versus Emma Stone. Mm. Part of me thinks Sandra Hüller might pull out a surprise win.
Yeah, I've heard.
People in the Academy really love her in Anatomy of a Fall, and they also really love Zone of Interest. And yeah. I don't know. I just, part of me feels like maybe that could be like a big shocker. But, you know, obviously Lily Gladstone is great, and that would be a very exciting win as well.
Yeah, I think sort of politically, I'd be happy for Lily to win it. In terms of actually the best performance, I'd probably go for Emma Stone. And Sandra Hüller, I for Zone of Interest more than for Anatomy of a Fall. But she's good in Anatomy of a Fall. I just think that's kind of fairly humdrum film. I think it's a little bit elevated by the fact it's foreign, by the fact we're reading subtitles. I mean, it's good. It's great. Justine Treat is great, but it's not. I think people are going a bit crazy over something, which is okay. Zone of Interest, that's the one that I feel almost is too good for the Oscars. I kind of think I don't want that to be in the conversation at all. It's just like, no, get your dirty, glittery fingers off that masterpiece. I don't even want it. Yeah, I don't even want it. You know, that would actually demean the film. It doesn't need an Oscar. It doesn't want an Oscar. Leave it alone.
But at the same time, how amazing is that that movie is in Best Picture and Best Director?
Yeah.
I mean, that's crazy.
Oh, I think it's the best film, you know. I think Oppenheimer's really good, but I think it's the best film by a country mile.
I was at an event last night with Academy members, and I of course was asking them like, what did you like? What are you gonna vote for? And this actress who shall remain nameless was like, oh, that Nazis in the Backyard movie.
The Nazis in the Backyard movie. Okay, tell us who that was. Tell us now. Tell me now who that was. 3, 2, 1, you're back in the room. Well, thank you for telling us that. Oh, wow. That's the Nazis in the Backyard. How to sum up a movie. Yeah, that's like Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot. Nothing happens twice.
That'll be in the title of my next book, Nazis in the Backyard.
Excellent. Well, Michael, thank you so much for the book. I really enjoyed it. And that's coming from someone who was initially an Oscar skeptic, but highly recommend it for all my listeners. And thanks for talking to me.
Well, this has been a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
I hope you enjoyed the conversation. I certainly did. Hopefully Michael did as well. If you wish, you can also listen to the sister podcast, Cinema Italia, which is a exploration and celebration of Italian cinema, available where all podcasts are. And we also have a serial called Connery, which is a novel read by Kai Ross and written by myself, a speculative fiction about a young man who meets Sean Connery and whose life is never quite the same. So both of those available wherever you get your podcasts. But until next week, take care.
Fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.